GC, neuramic acid, those two things out there, and they're like welcoming mats. Come on in here. Park yourself down here. Make yourself to home. Neuramic 5-GC has never been detected in normal human tissue. So if you take a human and you never feed it any dietary source of GC, there isn't any in the body. The only way you can get it is exogenously, that means from outside the body, and of course, we don't routinely do xenotransplants on ourselves, so it's going to be eating. Although it has recently been recorded to occur in some malignant samples. Now, there's a few areas, like with breast cancer, where they're questioning whether not only does it grab in GC from the surrounding area, but some of those breast carcinoma cells, they may have undergone some actual mutation in that CMAH gene so that it can now make GC. Cancer cells mutate very quickly. Their genomes are very on fire, and they mutate a lot. So they're questioning whether that could be the case, that when you develop cancer, especially a certain type of breast cancer, your cell at that point might start making GC, that breast cancer. Surprisingly, or not surprisingly, it says in schizophrenia, Campbell found the more serious the psychosis, the lower the sialic acid contact in the glycoproteins in the cerebral spinal fluid. When the schizophrenic state was treated successfully, the sialic acid contact rose to normal values. And it shows a chronic lithium treatment in animal models of schizophrenia causes change in the sialic acid content of rat synapsones, and concluded that the increased content of sialic acid in both glycoprotein and gangliosides in the synaptic membrane may alter electrical properties, leading to improvement in schizophrenic patients. It's a long way of saying neuramic acid appears to have some very close association with schizophrenia. We've already told you, we know that the 5-AC works a lot better for holding synapses than does the GC. And what they're referring to here is the amount of sialic acid you have, and the type appears to make a very important correlate to people that are in a schizophrenic psychotic state. Sialic acid levels in the blood are also used as markers for the acute phase response proteins. This is acute phase response is inflammation. Some acidic glycoproteins, for example, fibrinogen and haptoglobin, and glycoproteins with sialic acid as their terminal sugar, which increases markedly in response to cell injury. And what they went on to say is, if you get into a high inflammatory state, you need more neuramic acid. Well, if you're eating a lot of GC-rich food, guess what you do? Your body picks up more of the GC, and inflammation is due to the fact that you already have too much GC, guess what you've done? You just poured gasoline on the fire. Let's not bother with this. Eat, drink, and be wary. Okay, a prominent researcher. This is Barkey. This is what he looks like. And this is in Science 2008, October. A prominent researcher in the dual disciplines of sugar biology and evolutionary biology, Barkey at first purchased a few kilos of glands taken from the jaws of pigs. Next, his lab at the University of California, San Diego, minced and homogenized them to extract the mucins. From these mucins, proteins secreted by mucosal surfaces, they plucked off a sugar called neuramic 5-GC for short, and that's what Barkey's sweet tooth craved. 5-GC, which is also known as sialic acid, is made by chimpanzees and many other mammals, but not humans, and Barkey's group earlier had found a genetic mutation that prevents us from making it. Barkey suspected that when we are exposed to 5-GC, it incorporates into our cells, where it somehow makes humans more susceptible to a variety of diseases. The first step was to figure out how it entered the body. Thus, the pig spit experiment. Barkey reasoned that 5-GC could enter humans through food that contains it, such as red meat and milk products. To prove it, he proposed ingesting huge amounts of pig 5GC and seeing where it went. I'm going to jump over here. To establish a baseline, Barkey restricted what he put in or on his body for 2 days before the experiment. No red meats, milk products, or lanolin shampoos, all of which contain 5GC. Then he checked into a clinical research center at UCSD, and drank 150 milligrams of the 5GC dissolved in 100 milliliters of water. It was slightly sweet and sour and slightly acidic, said Barkey. Pig spit connoisseur. He wasn't particularly worried that the 5GC, full name, and it gives the full name, would make him sick. It was like eating 14 pork steaks, he said. People do that on July 4th, but to be safe, the clinical center kept him under observation all day, taking blood samples every 2 hours. No side effects surfaced. Urine, saliva, and hair trimmings over the next week all showed increased levels of neuronic 5GC. Closer analysis showed that his cells had actually taken it up and incorporated it on their surfaces, as they do with other sialic acids, in the synthesis of new glycans. Two of Barkey's colleagues did the same self-experiment with similar results, which they published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences in October 2003. There's no example I know of where you eat something foreign that outfoxes the biochemical system and becomes part of you, no different from molecules made in your own body, Barkey says. There's no other example I know of where you eat something foreign. So then he goes on to say that human is strongly ties human disease with 5GC. It's a very concrete example of how our susceptibility to disease might govern by our diet, says Carolyn Bertese, a carbohydrate chemist at UC Berkeley. And then she calls, he said that Barkey has done something incredibly creative. I don't want to read this whole thing because of time. Let's read down here. Some forms of neuronic 5GC are seen as foreign by the human immune system, and we sometimes create antibodies to it. Barkey repeats that these antibodies may contribute to autoimmune diseases, cancers, and heart, problems seen in humans but not chimps. Pathogens can directly bind to 5GC. Remember I told you that certain viruses look for it? Bind directly to 5GC on cell surfaces, and one strain of the malaria parasite does just that, readily causing diseases in chimps but not in humans. In other words, the Ricinawe, the Plasmodium Ricinawe, only affects the chimps because it's got GC, and the falciforme only affects humans because we've got the AC when the malaria attacks when the protozoan attacks. Any way you look at it, 5GC proves the point like never before. You are what you eat. That's where I got the title from this. It wasn't original with me. It's original with the guy who first discovered this. So consider the delicious irony. E. coli that produces E. coli, the bad guy, 0157, produces a toxin, which is toxic to the cell. It gets in there and disrupts the cells and kills it, causes it to explode. And it's in this paper, it's dubbed SUBAB, that's sub-antibody, toxin, contaminates red meat and milk products. So you have this Escherichia coli 0157 that makes this chemical that's really bad for us. Okay, it kills cells. And humans who ingest these foods incorporate 5GC into their cells. So you're eating some cheese or you're eating some steak, and if that steak happens to be contaminated with this E. coli 157, all right, the bad chemical that it makes that will kill your cell is dependent upon finding the GC on the cell so it can go in and kill it. And the only way it's going to get that GC is since you've ate the meat, the GC goes along with it, the cell incorporates it on, waves a flag to this antibody that then is able to come in, kill the cell. So the meat not only carries the missile, but it also carries the homing device for that missile to come in and do the destruction. It's a twofer. They're more likely to become seriously ill. Again, this paper is saying the same thing. This study presents the first example of a bacterial toxin showing a marked preference for 5-GC-containing glycans and is potentially significant in the context of host susceptibility to toxin-mediated disease. Indeed, glycans terminating in, remember GC sequences, are widely expressed on the cells of many mammals, including livestock, suggesting an evolutionary reason for the emergence of this selective binding preference. 5-GC is not produced by bacteria or plants, is lower absent in poultry and fish, but abundant red meats and bovine milk. However, humans are the known exception among mammals. 5-AC predominates because of the CMAH mutation. And here down the bottom, the 5-GC can only have originated from the diet as there is no human alternative pathway for 5-GC biosynthesis. Ironically, red meat and dairy products, the richest dietary sources of 5-GC, are the very foods that most commonly are contaminated with this toxin. And I won't show you this. This is a picture right here. If you could see it better, you would see that it fits in, this toxin fits perfectly into the curvature of the 5-GC, and it doesn't fit very well in the AC at all. And it has to fit in perfectly like a lock and key to open up for the cell to let it in. And remember we were talking about these sitting out here, a toxin. You see, what you're seeing out here is, this is a glycoprotein. Hormones will hook onto them and cause them to change and actually affect what happens in the cell, because new messengers that are sitting under here are triggered and they go into the nucleus and they cause proteins to come off of the DNA and get the DNA expressed. Toxins, we just talked about one of them, they look for them too. And then when they find them, they jump on and they go. Remember I said viruses? They look for the GC too. We're talking about GC here. Bacterium, they look for the GC too. That's the welcome mat. That's what they attach to. Other cells also attach. Sialic acid, when I was in medical school, it was described as like mortar between in your shower when you have
The tiles.
It's the mortar between the tiles. So not only does it help to identify yourself, but it also presents a mechanism whereby one cell hooks up to the other. And so when you have GC versus AC, you again run into difficulties in the cells binding together, and when they bind together, they form a barrier for bacteria to get in between the cells. Whoops, I want to keep going forward. All right, this is from the New York Times, 2009, October 3. I still have 25 minutes, so we're going to go as fast as we can. This is an important story, and it carries a very important point. We've been talking a lot about biochemistry, and I don't want us to miss other parts of this very big picture. This isn't just a biochemical problem. As big as that problem is, guess what, folks? You get more. Stephanie Smith, a children's dance instructor, thought she had a stomach virus. The aches and cramping were tolerable the very first day, and she finished her classes. Then her diarrhea turned bloody, her kidneys shut down, seizures knocked her unconscious. The convulsions grew so relentless that the doctors had to put her in a coma for 9 weeks. When she emerged, she could no longer walk. The affliction had ravaged her nervous system and left her paralyzed. Ms. Smith, 22, was found to have a severe form of foodborne illness caused by E. coli, which Minnesota officials traced to the hamburger that her mother had grilled for her for their Sunday dinner in early fall 2007. I ask myself every day, why me? Why me from a hamburger, Ms. Smith said. In the simplest terms, she ran out of luck in a food safety game of chance whose rules and risks are not widely known. Meat companies and grocers have been barred from selling ground beef tainted by the virulent strain E. coli known as 0157H7 since 1994, after an outbreak of Jack in the Box restaurants left 4 children dead. Yet tens of thousands of people are still sickened annually by this pathogen, federal health officials estimate, with hamburger being the biggest culprit. Ground beef has been blamed for 16 outbreaks in the last 3 years alone, including the one that left Ms. Smith paralyzed from the waist down. This summer, contamination led to a recall of beef from nearly 3,000 grocers in 41 states. Ms. Smith's reaction to the virulent strain of E. coli was extreme, but tracing the story of her burger through interviews and government and corporate records obtained by the New York Times shows why eating ground beef is still a gamble. Neither the system meant to make the meat safe nor the meat itself is what customers have been led to believe. The meat industry treats much of its practices and the ingredients in ground beef as trade secrets. Wonder why. While the Department of Agriculture has inspectors posted in plants and has access to production records, it also guards those secrets. So the government, the watchdog, who's there for your safety and mine, doesn't tell you what's going on there. It's a secret. Now think for a moment. What could be so secret about the way that they cut up a carcass? Do you think it's something special that they're worried we might go cut up our carcasses the same way if we went to do the butchering? So why would they need a trade secret? What's so important that they don't want you to know? Federal records released by the department through the Freedom of Information Act. So now the New York Times went in and sued them in court to try to get the information from these slaughterhouses where this meat came from. They had to go and sue to get it. The federal records released by the department through the Freedom of Information Act blacked out details of Cargill's, that's the main company, Cargill's grinding operation that could be learned only through copies of the documents obtained from other sources. So they had to go and get, obviously, past employees or whatever, to get them the real information of what happened. Because even under the Freedom of Information Act, what they got from the government watchdogs who were there, the important stuff was blacked out so they couldn't read it. You know, like a nuclear science trigger type of ingenious device that we don't want the Chinese to get. They're putting it that in the same level of important government secrets as trying to keep from you and I how they package meat. I can see the connection. Let's see. Those documents illustrate the restrained approach to enforcement by a department whose missions include ensuring meat safety and promoting agricultural markets. Within weeks of the Cargill outbreak in 2007, USDA officials swept across the country conducting spot checks at 224 meat plants to assess their efforts to combat E. coli. Although inspectors had been monitoring these plants all along, so they've been monitoring them, these new officials found serious problems at 55 that were failing to follow their own safety plans. I'm feeling better already. As with other slaughterhouses, the potential for contamination is present every step of the way, according to workers and federal inspectors. The cattle often arrive with smears of feedlot feces that harbor the E. coli pathogen, and the hide must be removed carefully to keep it off the meat. This is especially critical for trimming slices from the outer surface of the carcass. Federal inspectors based at the plant are supposed to monitor the hide removal, but much can go wrong. Workers slicing away the hide can inadvertently spread feces to the meat, and large clamps that hold the hide during processing sometimes slip and smear the meat with feces, the workers and inspectors say. Greater Omaha vacuums and washes carcasses with hot water and lactic acid before sending them to the cutting floor, but these safeguards are not foolproof. as the trimmings are going down the process line into the combos or boxes, no one is inspecting every single piece, said one federal inspector who monitored Greater Omaha and requested anonymity because he was not authorized to speak publicly. The E. coli risk is also present at the gutting station where the intestines are removed, the inspector said. And what they went on to say there is that, and I meant to include it and I forgot to add it, is that the meat that came from that in her hamburger came from four different places. One was from Uruguay, one was from Texas, one was from Kansas, and one was from Minnesota. And what they do is they get up the scrappings from the floor when they cut out to make steaks or different other cuts, and they sweep those up, put them together, and grind them, and that's what you get for your hamburger. And a very small amount of birds and reptiles. And I'm not going to go through this. Nor am I going to go through this. Okay, let's look at this. This is from Varkey again. It's from the laboratory investigation 2007. It says sialic acids are typically found as terminal monosaccharides attached to cell surface glucoconjugates. They play many important roles in many physiological and pathological processes, including microbinding, that leads to infection, regulation of the immune response, and progression and spread of human malignancies, and in certain cases, of human evolution. And this is, again, just in diagram. All I wanted to see is right up here. That's the uramic acid right there. Right here is the either 2,3 or 2,6 galactose. If it came from human origin, it's probably 2,6 galactose. And if it came from a dietary source, it's 2,3. So you can see they're right there at the end. We're not going to worry about this. Yeah, we now know that all normal humans have varying and sometimes substantial levels of circulating antibodies against 5GC. And then it says that they're one of the strongest epitones around. This is from Laboratory Investigation 2007. And down here at the bottom, a more serious possibility is that the formation of antigen-antibody complexes, which could secondarily enhance immune reactions against the polypeptide itself. In other words, as I said before, the 5GC, especially if you put in galactose 2,3 at the bottom, as a real epitome is another way of saying a strong antigen. Those are really highly reactive to the body. And I believe this, they're the ones that are going to show us. Okay. Instead of reading this, I'm going to try to give it to you real quickly because time is running out. We don't have time, the luxury of going through everything. Here again, it's going to talk about what it's talking about is that cancerous cells tend to have way more of the 5GC than regular cells. And I already told you it's because they don't want to make it. They love to be able to pick it up from their environment and incorporate it. With the exception possibly of certain type of breast cancer, which maybe has actually mutated and can produce its own. That's the only exception. They pick it up from the diet. And so everyone says, well, great. This could be a way that we could maybe target cancer cells by infusing which I don't know what they're referring to here, but even more antibodies that are better than what you and I produce, which I don't know how they're coming up with this, but synthetic antibodies against GC, and we can knock them off. What they found out is that when the T cells start multiplying because they see cancer is there and they're going after that cancer and trying to destroy it, because you know your body and my body, cancer arises twice a week. And you know, those of us who are cancer free, it's because our body stops it, finds those cells and destroys them. The T cells are responsible for that, the T white blood cells. The trouble is, when the T white blood cells hear that an antigen has hit the market, In other words, we've got a foreign cell there, which it perceives cancer as being a foreign cell, because not just the GC business, but other glycoproteins that are on the outside of cancer cells are changed. And the cancer cell is basically, its inner work, the DNA has been changed, and now is producing things that it wasn't before, and not producing things that it was before. And one of the other changes are in some of these other markers on the outside of the cell. So the T cells get excited. They say, we've got cancer going on, and the T cells start multiplying very quickly. And as they multiply, they don't have time to make neuronic acid. So if you're eating meat and there's a lot of GC around, they pick it up and put it on the outside of their own cell. So you're making lots of T cells now. Those are the armed soldiers that are going to go destroy these cancer cells. But you've got all around them GC. And guess what the B cells are saying? The other type of white blood cell that hits infections. They go, we're being invaded by a foreign infection again. Some more of this GC. So they make antibodies, more antibodies that go off and kill off the T cells. So the very soldiers that you're that you're depending upon to knock out your cancer, your own immune system is knocking them out thanks to the GC, which you have ingested in your diet and make available to them. Now, if you figure if you were a plant-based diet, so you were only ingesting AC, what's that going to do? It's going to leave those T cells are going to grab the AC that you had from your beets and salad and some tempeh and a little bit of soy, whatever you had, and that's cool. Everything's fine. Those T cells now can go out unfettered, and your own immune system isn't going to take care of them. They're go after them. They're free to do what they do best, and that's kill cancer. That's what this is talking about. So let us move on. This is where it says it. However, deposition of natural, this is an antibody, it's an Ig antibody that the body makes, can also potentially target healthy proliferating immune cells, that's the T cells, for death following the incorporation of dietary 5GC on those immune cells. And these graphs and things like this that we have up here are just demonstrating that fact. One other thing, now remember I said inflammation was so important? Well, they said, okay, this paper is a great paper, because they said in this paper, how do we know that if a person eats some meat and gets some GC in their system, and if we can get there, I'll show you a paper that says that the endothelial cells are the most likely non-cancerous cells, because they're in the blood, facing the blood the whole time, to pick up the GC. Well, so they're going to look at human endothelial cells. They're going to say, okay, if these endothelial cells have the GC, and if some human antibodies happen to latch onto those, does the antigen antibody complex, which always, in all other times, precipitates an inflammatory response, does it make an inflammatory response? Do we know that this really is a source of inflammation? And what this paper showed was, yes, this is a control. this was done in humans. And this is the control. This is human tissue that has from someone who has had a significant dietary exposure to GC. And they take it out, and they have a fluorescent antibody that binds onto that antigen to show that it's present. And this is a person that they exposed to a high dietary amount of GC, but they gave them a synthetic, it's called NS398, it's a non-steroidal. It blocks the formation of from arachidonic on down to make the chemicals that promote the inflammatory response. So in other words, they turned off the switch. They said, okay, we're going to see if this antibody antigen complex causes inflammation. And the way we're going to do it is we're going to have a control group that's going to get exposed to a meal that was benign and a control group that has not been, has received very little GC. There is a little bit there. Then we're going to feed two other groups high amounts of the GC. Then we're going to go looking for the antibody to see if the antibody is there. And then we're going to say, with one group, we're going to give them a substance that blocks the inflammatory response and see if we see a difference here that is picked up, it's red, indicating the presence of inflammatory chemicals and an inflammatory response. In the system where they blocked inflammation, even though the antibody and antigen are present, you don't see any activation of inflammation. In the group where there is no blockage of the inflammatory response, you see an inflammatory response. So that definitely proves that the 5-GC antigen and the antibodies that you make against it do trigger an inflammatory response.
The AG.
GC is mammalian, AC is human.
Okay. If somebody has, say, osteo or rheumatoid arthritis, if they eat a lot of things containing the AG, will that block the inflammatory so that they don't have to take as many NSAIDs?
Generally speaking, yes. There's a number of papers out there that shows people who have, for instance, rheumatoid arthritis, have the severity of their symptoms decrease if they go on a strict plant-based diet. And they have two different... I don't have that paper included here.
But they couldn't artificially give them, say, a capsule of extra HD every day to help to...
They're getting billions and billions of this GC from the meat products they eat.
But if they're not eating those and they want to stop the inflammation?
Then guess what? Your body makes AC, and it will... You can't make GC, and if you stay away from the GC, pretty soon AC is the only thing your body has on it.
Okay.
How long does... how do you get rid of GC if you have it?
Time. It wears out.
How fast?
I don't know. I can't tell you the answer to that.
I don't know how much you have, I suppose.
Yes, and your own system and how fast your cells are turning over, and do you have other inflammation going on? There's really many, many factors that would play into it. I don't have a clue how long it would take to rid it from your system.
Well, then why does a person who has been a vegetarian all their lives end up with these degenerative diseases? It shouldn't happen, according to what you're saying.
Do they have any milk products? Cheese is just as bad as a slab of beef. Mm-hmm. Cheese is, look at it, is solid GC. And see, when I was growing up, I felt so... My mother said, oh, don't worry, we're vegetarians, and this is why. And in the meantime, we had cheese probably 3 or 4 times a week, and my mom said, it's good for you, it's got calcium. So all these years we've been smug. I don't know why we live 7 years longer on the with the amount of sugar and milk products that Adventists eat. They consume... You know, cheese and wine is not a good way to go after it. And I wish we had time to talk about alcohol tonight because, well, that's another day. Let's forget that. And just down here, dietary 5-GC is primarily found in red meat and milk products. Remember, it's always milk products here. And of the milk products, the worst offender is cheese. Not to give another kudos to Ellen White, but what did she say? Cheese has no place at our tables.
Mm-hmm. And we were always told that that was because of the way they made cheese in those days, and that isn't done that way today.
No. See, there we go, trying to help the lady out who obviously didn't know what she was talking about. You know, so old and decrepit and so anti-anything fun. That's going to be another one for Ron Numbers. You see, there's no way she could have known about GC and AC because it was first discovered in 1998 by Varkey. So his book, Prophetess of Health, hopefully this is going to get out, and it's going to throw a whole new light on, which his main premise, if any of you read it, was any information Ellen White had was available to her from non-divine sources when she wrote. That sums it up in two sentences. And the answer to, I would say to him, is no, not true. Well, does it really make a difference? Remember we said chronic inflammation is so important? Do we have any papers that say, well, if you eat a plant-based diet versus a meat-based diet? Remember I said type 2 diabetes, and I said you get inflammation, and what happens is that your insulin receptors don't work as well, and also it increases the amount of cortisol and other things which inhibit the ability of insulin to work. Well, so someone did a study, and they looked at 326,876 person years. They had 37,000 participants, and I think they looked at it, for 8.8 years. So they had a total of 300,000 person years they were looking at. And we don't have time to go through the paper. Now remember, this is not causative. This is not where we start out with two sets of children and we say, this set's only going to get plant-based or mom's milk and then plant-based food. And this set is going to get formula and we're going to start them on meat, parade meat things, and then we're going to see what they do. And we'll try to keep all of the other factors as equal as we can. If you want to really prove something, you're going to have to do some type of a scientific design like that, which I don't see happening anytime in the near future. So the best we can do is look at things that are associative. And what we find here is that it says our data indicates that higher consumption of total red meat, especially various processed meats, may increase the risk of developing type 2 diabetes in women. They have to say may because they don't know. What they found is in the women who eat a lot of meat that they followed over this 8.8 year, none of them had any diabetes at the beginning. A larger number of them as they got older developed type 2 diabetes than those who were not eating red meat. They didn't even exclude milk products in this, which would be a real variable, as you could tell. But even with that in the mix, you still got a difference. And they found the same thing for both low-fat vegan diet and a diet based on ADA guidelines, improved glycemic and lipid control in type 2 diabetic patients. These improvements were greater with a low-fat vegan diet. I'm just showing you, does this really translate into some differences that we can find when we look at large groups of people? And I'm giving you two examples. Yes, there is.
What about eggs?
Eggs do have a small amount of GC in them. And you'll say, well, I thought you said birds don't have it in them. But for some reason, the eggs do. Small amount, not a lot. And then the rest of the egg, it may have some 2,6 galactose in it, but other than that, if you want to look at an antigen producer, the eggs, I got to be honest with you, aren't that high.
Aren't that high?
They don't have a lot of antigen in them, whether it's 2,3 galactose, or if it's 5 GC. They have very little of both in them.
So it's a better source of protein than milk or cheese or...
Yes, yes. But let me tell you, guess what is the highest source of protein on a per gram basis? Legumes. Beans. Yes.
What?
Beans. So in other words, if people say, but how are you going to get your protein? Well, I'll go to the highest concentration I can get. I'll eat some legumes.
And I'm allergic to them.
It's a combination. If you want a complete amino acid diet, you would go for the legumes and rice.
Yes, that too. And our cereals. They say you have to get both. But if you're just talking protein, You'll get the biggest bang for your buck if you're going to go with legumes. So, yes, inflammation is the missing link. And I hope I've really presented to you in a short, I know you may think it's getting interminably long here, but in a short period of time, I've tried to squeeze a whole bunch of papers and a whole bunch of research and a whole bunch of biochemistry to give you an idea that you really are what you eat. Now, Ellen White was very clear that the health message was going to lead the way. And one part, the next part of her talk, which I'm not going to do tonight, is to discuss a whole new area, the 5-ACGC. Ignore this, because we're not going to talk about this tonight either. The whole ACGC thing is big, and it's definitely germane to the problems we're seeing today, which is the obesity, and I don't have time to go through with you why, and I have papers that show that if you eat meat, you're more likely to be obese, and the way they do it is they make the person their own control, and they switch meat eaters to vegan diet, and they check all kinds of things, including a lean body mass and all those other things, and the plant-based diet is less lipogenic in nature. That means it doesn't make fat, it doesn't produce fat as well as meat diets do. So it helps on the weight front, it helps also on the autoimmune front, because when you're in a constantly inflamed state, you also produce chemicals like cortisol, which promote central obesity. And there's a long reason why, and cortisol impedes the work of insulin. And cortisol also causes other things to be put out, like angiotensin, and then that's made into angiotensinogen, which is made into angiotensin 1 and 2, and that then causes aldosterone and other things to be put. All of these things work together to fight insulin. And they'll also stimulate glucagon, which is an antidote to insulin. I mean, they do exactly the opposite things. So the rise of metabolic syndrome, which I told you before was diabetes, obesity, clotting abnormalities, and hypertension, is, I believe, has a major source of where that's coming from, is meat eating. And because we're living longer, we're finding it in people as they get above 50, 55, because we're now living to 75 or 80, whereas in 1800, when they all had almost total meat diets, they were dying at 40 to 50. The chronic exposure that it takes as it builds up, and although people were dying of heart attacks then at 42, I don't want to misrepresent it, but we are seeing, by medical science, keeping people alive, doing things like putting in stents in their coronary arteries, which is a direct result of what we've just described, so they can go on to develop diabetes type 2. You see what I mean? So you can get all of the four pillars, because medical science helps people live long enough so they end up developing all of them before they die. But what we didn't discuss, which is fascinating, is, and those of you who were in the past lectures will remember, that our intestines take a whole DNA links of 250 to 400 nucleotides long and incorporate them right across the genetic mucosa into the blood intact. And I have those slides to show again, with the rabbit the rabbit transposable elements. And the transposable elements that, for instance, that you especially get from eating pork can get into your human nucleuses and talk with our own transposable elements, and they are synergistic, and although they don't have the exact paper to prove this, there seems to be an association between higher incidences of transposable element generated disease in humans because of what they've picked up from the pig. And it's the number one cause of this pathway for an etiology of disease. Now, what did the Bible say specifically? Which did it pick out and say you weren't to eat? Because the pig is by far the biggest offender in this area. It's the one that outstrips the others by far in being able to do this. So eating meat's a two-edged sword. Not only are you going to get the 5GC, but you're also picking up DNA material. Hence, the name of the talk, you are what you eat. So, that we didn't get to discuss tonight. That's another topic, and it's quite interesting and has great papers. And this is starting into that. This is pig brains in Minnesota when they were in a gentleman started developing some autoimmune diseases from inhaling. Because the gentleman that had to cut the pig head open and remove the brain were getting these horrible autoimmune diseases. It was from the fact that they were reacting to the antigen from the pig. Ends up being certain things on the pig's surface and also DNA. And also that they are not doing any more xenografts from pigs to humans because the humans are getting infected with all kinds of viruses and die. They put a moratorium on it. Because the transposable elements in the pig are reacting with our transposable elements and the system goes wild and viruses that are coming out of the pig DNA are infecting the humans with these are transposable elements and causing the humans to die. Another reason why we weren't supposed to mess with the pig. Because their transposable elements and ours talk and work together, and they can set up a real cavalcade to bring down the human body.
What's so terrible about the other things that the Bible tells us we shouldn't eat?
Well,
shellfish.
Yes, like shellfish. I have not read any papers on those because I got to be honest with you, I haven't been as interested in it. People say, and I don't know if this is true, so I'm just throwing this out there, it's because they're bottom scavengers and what they pick up from the bottom of the ocean floor. But I suspect if looked upon, and this also means that someone has to be interested enough out there in the scientific community to go and take a look at it. And I don't even know if it's out there. So, but if I were a guessing person, I had to guess on this. My guess is we're going to find something biochemistry speaking that we've found, for instance, in the pig. But if it's there yet, I don't know where it is in the literature, and I'm not aware of it. That would be absolutely a guess. Totally a guess.
This all makes sense. Why aren't things worse? I should have 500 patients on my surgery schedule tomorrow and a waiting line for emergency room clear over here to the church because there's a lot of people, in fact, I think most people, who have a very high meat, milk consumption. So what's protecting them from just falling apart when they're 55 or sooner?
Well, there's probably another.
This is really compelling.
There's a number of answers. Number one, medicine gives them a lot of drugs and different things to help them along, to help them get over this. I'm over Grandview. I give anesthesia every day, and I was stuck today in the vascular room. We're backed up forever, and we call them vasculopaths, and you can actually see it, all the arteries in the body, but the one that happens to be clogged at that time, wherever it is we're working on, are in the heart room. The other thing is this, this chronic inflammation doesn't do you in overnight. Your body, it becomes like a parasite and a host. The body starts to accommodate to the parasite, trying to live with it somehow, walling it off and protecting itself through a number of different defensive mechanisms, which in the end make the problem worse, because that's how atheromatous plaques form. The body tries to wall it off and form it, and then it pops open, and we get the cascade for coagulation takes place. So the body is, part of it's got to go, in my opinion, to the way the body was created, to be able to withstand the steady onslaught. I had a special slide, and I had to go, I didn't have a scanner home, so I went to the hospital today and got it scanned, and I had them email it to me, but it never got to me. I don't know, somehow they got the wrong address or whatever, but it's a most fascinating slide. I was going to put it up, and I'm going to tell you about it, because it's so, I think it's just remarkable. R.C. Sanford is a population geneticist who used to teach at Cornell, which is in New York, State of New York, and he was a full professor of genetics. He has a PhD in genetics and in plant genetics. But he became interested in population genetics, which is a very tough area of genetics, because and not only is it loaded with math, but you've got all kinds of variables when you're dealing with genes that just, it's mind-boggling. But he got interested in it, and he wrote a book, which I highly recommend. It's called Genetic Entropy. It is fabulously written, and it, to me, categorically, absolutely puts the kibosh on anyone that thinks that we evolved by genetic mutation. He was an atheist geneticist who kept having problems as he learned more about genetic population genetics, and finally he came to the conclusion that the central theorem of evolution was wrong, dead wrong. It scientifically could not have occurred, and he amassed a bunch of evidence and he printed it in a book, and he's done it in a very good way, so that I'm not saying everybody can read it, but most people could read it and at least get the basic idea of what he's saying. He gets technical in parts, and you skip that part. You know, half the book you're going to skip, but the other half you can read. He nails it. He nails it. And the reason I know that it is causing the evolutionary crowd a lot of problems is no one has come out and attacked it yet. And it's been out for 2 years, I think. And normally, they're like vultures. The minute there's any movement on a creation side, they're on it with all force. And there's been a very interesting silence, because he was one of them, and he completely takes it from a population genetics point of view and shows you that it could not have occurred. But he has a graph that I wish I would have, that I wanted to put up here for you. Yes?
Would you say the name of the book again?
Genetic Entropy, E-N-T-R-O-P-Y, and his name is S-A-N-F-O-R-D, Sanford, and I think it's R-C, R-C Sanford, S-A-N. If you put Sanford in on Amazon, it'll come up.
Okay.
He has an interesting graph there. Oh, he no longer is an atheist. He is now a Christian. He feels that we can only have come from an intelligent design situation. I do not know whether he believes in a six-day creation or has ID or relation. I don't know. He doesn't tell you in the book. He just tells you at the end. At the beginning, he says, I need to tell you, I started out as an atheist. I'm now a Christian. I'm writing this book because I don't believe that. I firmly believe that evolution is taught by the scientific community is absolutely scientifically unsubstantiated. It is cannot work, period. And you need to read the book. I don't need to tell you about that. We don't have time tonight anyway. It's many hours of discussion. But that said, now I'm going to get back to the graph. What he did was he took the book of Genesis and he plotted the average age as it fell off from Noah down to about 1800, when it was 36 or 40 years was the average age of death. And he does a regression analysis, and he does some other mathematical stuff, which is really neat. And he comes up with a number, and then he goes ahead and he shows you how that number would perfectly match a line if you were increasing the amount of mutation within the human genome. If you were turning up the mutation rate, and that the mutation rate was increasing from generation to generation. Now, I'm going to say to you, he doesn't come to this conclusion. I'm coming to this conclusion, and I'm going to be talking to him. So there's a number of things we want to discuss, because what he's done and what I am doing, sort of, but I haven't done that yet. Anyway, he said that the numbers as recorded in Genesis had to have been real numbers. Because the curve fits so perfectly what you would find if all of a sudden you were increasing the mutation rate in human. He says it fits population genetics perfectly. The number that you get, the way you get the slope. And so he says that's one reason why I know Genesis has to be accurate, is because if someone was fudging the numbers, you would not find them fitting the perfect curve that you find with increasing mutation rates. Now, what happened when they came out of the ark? What were they told they could do? Okay. I already, those of you who were in my last lectures, already saw how we incorporate DNA from what we eat. I have a whole group of material here why we don't pick up any DNA from plants, vegetables, or fruits. Plants, vegetables, and fruits, I'm going to digress for a moment and I'm going to finish this, come with a number of chemicals called diphenols as the main group. And what these guys do is they bind onto the DNA in the plant. Anytime the plant is disturbed, if you're going to eat a leaf or you're going to eat some fruit, it completely binds to the DNA so that when you ingest it, you will not absorb any of it and it goes completely out as waste. We see it as it helps with the fiber. You know, if you eat more fruit, you don't have to take those fiber pills. Well, it's in that fiber stuff, these phenols that grab onto the DNA. In fact, when scientists went to try to get to map the genome of certain things like corn, and I'm digressing again, Monsanto is bad people. They are doing bad things to our food source. I'm going to leave it there. Let's go back here. When they went to go and get the genome and map out the genome for certain plants, they had a horrible time getting the DNA because these phenols would bind it up. Anytime they went in to crush the plant to try to get down to the cells, they couldn't get it. So it was even published, which I have here in one of my slides, in one of the journals where they came up with a special way that they have to carefully take the plant they're trying to get the DNA from, and they have to go through a number of careful steps so that they can get the DNA out. They have to jump through hoops. And they have to carefully tease it out. And what they found is if people who are eating meat eat vegetables with the meat, the vegetables help to cover the meat eating because they bind the DNA in the meat too. Not all of it, but some of it. And there's been many studies that compare people who just eat red meat and don't eat vegetables, and then you add on vegetables and they do better. They have longer life. They're less likely to get ill. So the DNA is very important. Coming over here. So don't worry about vegetables. Don't worry about fruit. Eat them to your heart's content. You will not pick a bit of DNA, and they do have transposable elements in them. But they're transposable elements, even if you pick some of them up, don't talk to ours. They don't interact. But you don't need to worry. The Creator stopped all that. And there's something else I was going to show you up here about taking supplements. My daughter, 5 years ago, she went to a special culinary school in New York City. And she said, Dad, you know, we're to eat whole fruits. You shouldn't take vitamin C. You should just eat more oranges. And I said, oh, come on. Where'd you learn that? The Star? You know, we know how to make ascorbic acid. We can get it out. I can take it. where are you going to school? Where am I paying this tuition to? These guys are a bunch of nutcakes. We've got to move you into a more 21st century type of school. Well, I was totally wrong. I couldn't have been more wrong. She was right. Some more papers that I had, I obviously had a 4-hour talk. Some more papers that I had in here show how the plants, the early slide that I showed you with the NF-kappa-B protein that I pontificated on at length about apoptosis and the other way going over into inflammation, and all those chemicals down there that were on the bottom are all natural chemicals that are found in fruits primarily and vegetables. Those plants, the plants that they're taken from, have other cofactors with them that have to be with them or they don't work. So if you don't eat the fruit, the chances are you're not going to get the benefit. So taking vitamin C, you might get, I'm making this up, I don't have a figure, but I'm going to say 20 or 30% maybe if that. And in vitamin E, for instance, they found that it causes increased growth of lung cancer patients. They started giving them vitamin E and they got the lung cancer worse. Especially here, and I have the paper, I have a slide for it. You've heard about the agouti mice? Any of you heard about those in epigenetics? Oh, dear me. We don't have time to discuss it. I will go ahead and find that slide if you want me to. If you want me to stop now, anyone who wants to go, feel free. You're not going to offend me. We'll consider the lecture done.
How about continuing next week?
I'm going to be in Montana next week. I'm going to show you...
The next week after that.
Well, I will be in town.
We'll come back.
Maybe I should do that. This is interesting, too. Never mind. I only bring stuff that I... this is what I'm talking about when we're talking about porcine and xenografts. Great. Let me see. I just want to show you this one thing, and then I will be done, I promise you. They're the agouti mice. Okay. They found some mice that the mothers in this mice, and these, they developed a strain of mice where the mothers were big and fat and yellow. Now, these are pups here. Okay, but the mothers were big, they were obese, they developed diabetes, and no matter if you kept their caloric intake the same as the non-agouti mice, they would gain a lot more weight. So they said, okay, what's the, how does this work? This agouti gene, they thought, this is the answer. This is going to tell us about obesity. We're going to come up with a medic, we're going to find out with something that can come in and block this gene, and people won't get fat, and life will be grand. So they went ahead, and this is always shown in epigenetic papers. I think Time Magazine had one on this. What they did was they gave the mothers of the agouti mice, they gave the mothers folate. And guess what happens? The mothers in the first generation had pups that looked like this. And then later generations, they had normal brown, black pups who didn't gain weight, like their mothers. Sometimes it happened in one generation, sometimes it happened in two. But for sure by the end of two. But some of them, if they gave the mothers enough folate, the pups became like this. And they said, that's it. We're going to start selling folate. This is a great idea. Except those pups started developing cancer. They started getting two or three different strains of cancer. And so they go, oh, no, what did we do here? How could this have happened? Well, what they found out was this. If you give someone folate that is extracted from green leafy vegetables or wherever they are going to get it, or even biosynthesized in a lab. It's picked up from the intestinal mucosa unchanged. It goes into the bloodstream and it hits the liver. As you know, the spleen-like blood flow empties into the portal vein and goes into the liver, and it makes a first pass through the liver. And when it goes through the liver, most of this folate is picked up and conjugated into an active form. And this active form is superactive. It goes into the cell nucleus, and what it does is it promotes methylation, and it starts methylating all over the place. And why these agoutis changed? Because there was a transposable element in the mothers who are big and were yellow and large and had diabetes. They have a transposable element which caused a nearby repressor gene that demethylated a repressor gene called the agouti gene that set this whole cascade off. Normally that gene is methylated early on in development. But because the transposable element sat right next to there, remember we talked in those other lectures about the transposable elements cause demethylation or change the whole methylation along a chromosome and even other chromosomes if new transposable elements come in? Well, I hope you remember that. That's a fact. I didn't talk about it. So what happened was the folate came in there and it's hypermethylator, so it methylated up that repressor gene, so it no longer repressed the normal gene that made normal pups. The repressor gene stopped a normal gene or genes which would make normal pups, but by being unmethylated by the transposable element, the repression on those genes stopped. And you got this. So if you take the repressor gene and you remethylate it, it now allows these other good genes to be expressed. And you get normal pups. But it didn't stop methylating with that one. It started methylating up and down the chromosome, and it methylated other genes which combat cancer. And so now the pups got cancer. However, if they gave the mother that had the agouti syndrome the folate through green leafy vegetables and things of that nature, the pups came out fine because the folate was picked up and changed in the mucosa, the mucosa of the mother rat, into a form of folate, an active form of folate that wasn't nearly as active as the one that's formed in the liver. And it does it methylates much more judiciously. So there is your clue on what you do with taking supplements. Generally speaking, and I'm saying generally speaking, you, if you eat a varied plant-based diet, with the exemption of zinc and B12, you should be able to get all of the supplements that you will take, and alpha-lipoic acid, that's one other one, that you're going to buy in the store, and you better throw in zinc. If you're a real avid plant-based diet person, you should take some zinc. But all the others, you'll pick up just fine. And not only will you pick them up just fine, you'll pick them up with all the other cofactors that as yet unidentified accompanying molecules that make it work the way it's supposed to work. So you can think of fruit as being containers filled with the supplements and the nutrition and the things that your body needs to function, and they're perfectly packaged. They're perfectly packaged. You can't improve on it. If you mess with them, you are going to detract them. So, not all fruits have, I mean, all of those stuff down there that I said on the bottom is trying to keep it. We could have gone through, I could have named you the different vegetables and fruits that they all come from. You need a wide range. So eat a lot of across, you know, you shouldn't just eat broccoli, broccoli, broccoli every day. That's not going to work if you're a new plant-based diet. You need to get a variant amount. And what I do for breakfast, because it is true, Ellen White says you're not supposed to eat vegetables with fruits. Now they've proven it causes it to petrify in your gut. Let's not go into the reasons why. It just does. And so what I've gone to is I eat lots of fruit in the morning, and you can eat with cereal. And then I eat my vegetables and other protein stuff the rest of the day. But I try to get 4 or 5 different fruits in the morning. And you're full. And you throw in some nuts with that, and I've got plenty of energy to go from 6 in the morning when I eat until 11 or 11:30 when I eat lunch. And there's other important fun things we could talk about, like they found that I've got the paper, I think, in these slides with mice that I won't tell you the gene, but there is a gene in mice that humans have one just like it, and they're looking again for the fat gene that they're trying to discover where it is. And what they find in the mice was that if they fed them juice that they squeezed that day from blood oranges, the experimental group got the blood orange juice. The control group got regular orange juice. Diet was the same. They found that the blood orange group didn't gain weight. And regular orange juice did. So they said, okay, well, forget the orange juice altogether, the control group. We'll just feed blood orange. So we're going to up the ante. We're going to keep the caloric intake in both of the mice, but in the blood orange group, they're going to get extra calories from the blood orange juice. And orange juice is highly caloric. And they still lost weight compared to the controls. And they absolutely kept the rest of their diets exactly the same. They sacrificed the animals, and what they discovered was, you know, through different methods like radioactive labeling, that there's something in the blood orange, they don't know yet, that causes suppression of a gene that has been marked to be one of those that increases the propensity for obesity. So, am I saying that you should go out and buy blood oranges? No, but I'm just telling you where the research is going. Do I eat blood oranges every morning? Yes. Okay. I've tried it for the last 3 weeks.
Where do you get them? Never heard of them. I buy mine at Dorothy Lane.
I have lost a belt size, and I haven't changed any of the other food I eat. It could be placebo. I don't care. I like it. I'm full, and I'm losing weight. So if 70% of what the drugs you take are placebo, that's fine by me.
I mean the whole orange.
And I'm trying to look around to see if this is worth pursuing more actively, because this paper just came out in January of this year in Science. So I don't know how many other people have come up with it.
Do you eat like one a day, or how many?
I eat one a day, but my good friend Mike Webster, who discovered it, he's eating 2 or 3 a day.
And has he lost more weight?
I don't know. He just started. He's been at it a week. I've been at it 3 weeks. And when he saw that I lost a belt size and I'm still eating the same amount, now he's maybe going a little overboard. He's eating them all the time.
What about blood orange juice?
It has to be fresh. And he's even located a place online that they'll squeeze it fresh and send it to you frozen. That's how you... So we're looking into this. This may end up being nothing more than an exercise in something fun. It's probably got a lot of placebo to it, but I don't care. It works for me, so there you go. I'm just telling you, there's other stuff like this out there. This is where we're going. This is where science is now beginning to head. I wasn't telling you that because I want you all to go out and buy blood oranges. I'm giving that as an anecdotal story. I'm not endorsing it, nor am I saying it's been proven to do nothing, okay? It's just an observation in my period. But that's where they're going, and there may be in the near future some real interesting breakthroughs having to do with this epigenetics, what you eat actually affecting your genes in ways beyond just eating something nutritious. It actually, with this the evidence from this is stuff you eat actually affects, turns on, or in this case, turns down or inhibits a gene in a mouse. And we have the same gene. And it's implicated to do the same thing in us, but we have more genes that maybe are different than the mouse does, even though we both have about 22,000. We're very close in the total number. But that's where it's going, and it's going with diet. And so one last slide that we are going to see is you eat for two reasons. One is for pleasure and one is for nutrition. And what you have to decide is which is more important for you, the pleasure part or the nutrition part. Now, most people that hear this go, I can't give up meat because I'm going to be giving the same talk at the hospital because I've been somewhat annoying because they eat so much meat there, I can't stand it. So I've been talking to people, and now they want to hear. So we're going to give them this talk. It's going to be watered down, and it's going to be something in 30 minutes, so it's, you know, attention spans don't wander. But if, now I lost the train of thought where I was going with this.
Pleasure or nutrition.
Here's the key. If you sit down and have a real heart-to-heart talk with yourself, and you say, you know, the reason I'm really eating, if you come down to it, the most important reason should be for nutrition, because I'm putting in what my body needs to keep functioning. I'm the source of supply for the factory, and you have about 100 trillion factories. And you are providing, you're the resource person, you're bringing in the supplies. So if you start thinking of your body in that way, the nutritional part starts coming up. Before I got into this, I thought of eating primarily was for pleasure, and if you got some nutrition, hey, great. You need to flip that. And the surprising thing is, all tastes are acquired. When I'm at the hospital and they say, you're a vegetarian. How long have you been vegetarian? All my life. No. Yes, I said all my life. No, you couldn't have grown up and not had meat. No, yes, here I am. I'm walking proof. And they go, I bet you long for meat, don't you? I said, no, yes. I can't stand meat. Absolutely, I want to spit it out. There is nothing tasty about it to me. They go, oh no, you're just joking. And one hospital where I was at, they actually went so far, because they used to bring up trays to the operating room when we were working at night, and I always said, the only thing I can get down there is a salad, so this is what I want. I don't want any cheese on it. So what they would do is they'd bring up the salad, and buried down deep would be some cut up pieces of chicken and some cheese. They were sure that if I inadvertently taste some of it, I would go, ding, 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 this is the best thing I've ever eaten. And I'd go, what did you do to my salad? They said, well, we thought if we could just get you to taste it. It's all acquired. And if you start eating the diet with nutrition as being the lead reason, guess what catches up? The pleasure, because your diet, your taste will change to match what you're eating. If you go over to the Maasai in Africa, they like fresh blood from their cattle. They think it tastes great. I would gag. I would throw it up. I even couldn't get it in my mouth. Everything is an acquired taste. Everything. There's nothing, with the exception of sugar, pure sugar and salt, which you have the receptors on your tongue, and some bitter taste. You have there's a fourth one, that's the hot, when you go to a Thai restaurant, you get the hot stuff. There's really four receptors. But it's an interplay between those four that register in your brain, and whether you like the taste or you don't or whatever. Those receptors will adjust. You just keep doing what you're doing for some time, and they'll adjust. They'll get up with you with what you're eating. They'll soon be reinforcing you. When I get up in the morning, I'm good. I get my banana, and I get this and that. And I'm hungry, and I'm going in there looking for it. I'm not thinking of anything more. When you eat a donut, what you're doing is you're eating all the calories, but you have stripped it of any
nutrition.
Morally acceptable capabilities. You are eating nothing but trash. There is nothing acceptable in them. It is, and here you've taken all that calories in, and you haven't taken the important nutrients that your cells depend upon to get them. So that's why a cup of coffee and a donut in the morning, and then a Big Mac at lunch with fries, and then in the evening, steak with a big cup of chocolate pie. Now, think that through. What did you get in that day's diet that's going to be helping with your NF kappa B protein that's teetering up there? Where are you pushing it? What about the 5GC? What about the DNA that you're picking up from the poor animal you ate?
There's no 5GC or in chocolate, is there?
No.
Oh, praise God.
So, anyway, that's what you've got to be thinking about. Like I said, if you want to eat meat, go for it. Now you know when you pick up that piece tomorrow, you can be thinking GC and DNA and autoimmune and inflammatory and antibodies and... Go for it. That ought to make you really salivate. So that's what I said. No pressure.
Just kill the pizza.
Have at it. Okay. We've got till 10.
Just
way over by you. So that's it. And we'll meet again sometime for further discussion.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
I'm